Good afternoon. Hi, it's Warren Olson. I'm here at our offices in downtown Denver. I'm going to try to get this call in before the afternoon monsoon hits. It seems like we've had this kind of wild weather for the last 6 days. I've lived in Denver a long time. It's the first time I can recall the word monsoons being used, I think. But anyway, thanks for joining me. I'm going to try to make this as productive as possible. As I think some of you have been on this before know that I do these periodic calls, which are really just kind of updates on kind of how First Western is seeing the economy and more importantly, how that's affecting the capital markets. So this afternoon, I'm going to really try to talk about three things. I'm going to kind of give you a brief recap of how the markets have done to date and the focus on brief there. Second, views on kind of what's going on in the global economy and what we're seeing, and then sort of how we're viewing the capital markets and my expectations, or probably the better word is guess, for the rest of the year. And then I know that several of you sent in questions, so I'll leave some time to at least try to answer a few of those questions. So kind of a brief recap. You know, despite the fact that you know, if you spend too much time, you know, watching CNBC or Bloomberg, you keep hearing these sort of dire, you know, financial and economic news. It's actually been a pretty benign period for investors the beginning of the year. So, you know, today, in terms of equities, the world equity market, that's kind of measured by the Morgan Stanley Capital International All World Index, it's up almost 5%. U.S. is doing a little bit better than the world. The S&P 500 is up about 7%. And, you know, if you look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which gets quoted a lot, that's up almost 10%. So pretty good backdrop. And, you know, despite all the news that we're hearing about Greece, and I'll get to more on that later, you know, European equities are up 3%. And then emerging market equities are actually lagging, and they're up only about 1% for the year. You know, we've been able to make money in bonds. Kind of broad government bonds are up about 3% for the year. Corporate bonds up about 4.5%. High yield bonds up about 6. Muni bonds, again, talk about that in a little bit more, but, you know, despite all these early dire predictions, up about 5%. And commodities were actually down a little bit for the year, despite oil being up 5%. And my favorite asset class, the thing that I love to hate, gold, being up about 10%. And, you know, it's interesting because we've gotten these positive returns against a backdrop of, you know, pretty negative macro, you know, news during the first half of the year. You know, in the United States, and I'll get into more detail here, but, you know, we've had pretty consistently disappointing economic news. You know, we've had slower than sort of expected GDP growth, higher than expected unemployment numbers. We saw the near shutdown of the federal government that literally got averted, you know, the weekend before that was supposed to happen. And now we've got our current crisis du jour, which is, you know, the president coming on, you know, on TV and basically scaring people that they're not going to get their Social Security checks and that we may see a government default on, you know, the 2nd of August. And, you know, both parties sort of finger pointing at each other as to whose fault is that. In Europe, you know, if it's pretty hard to go more than 10 minutes without hearing either the word Greece or the word Greece and the word contagion. There's worried about the rest of the acronym that I really like, the PIGS, which is Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. You know, we've seen the rating agencies move Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Greece, their sovereign debt to junk status, which is, you know, kind of non-investment grade. Again, a little bit more on that, but, you know, that was, of all of those, probably Ireland may be the most disconcerting since they've theoretically already had their bailout. And then in Japan, you know, Japan had this heartbreaking tsunami, you know, where all of the things that you saw were really just devastating. And then you had these fears of a, you know, Chernobyl-type major nuclear catastrophe. You know, Japan, as most of you know, is a major player in the global supply chain. And then moving on, you know, in the Middle East and North Africa, you know, we saw political unrest starting in Tunisia, regime change in Egypt, still open questions in Syria, Libya, possible Bahrain. So, you know, a lot of political turmoil. And so against that backdrop, you know, to see a fairly benign financial market, you know, makes you wonder whether the markets are essentially being Pollyannish and discounting everything, or if something else is afoot. And so I'm, you know, when I've been thinking about the global economy, you know, I've been calling it sort of the tale of two halves. You know, one half being the more developed market, again, primarily Europe, U.S., and Japan, and then the other tail being the emerging markets. And so in the developed market, again, in Europe, U.S., and Japan, we're clearly seeing below trend line growth. I'll talk about kind of why in a little bit. And then in the emerging markets, however, we're seeing pretty strong above trend line growth. And so when you smush is a technical term, by the way, you smush that all together, we're actually seeing really strong global growth. And so that's something I talked about earlier in the year, but we have not changed our view that the economic backdrop of the world is still strong, despite the fact that the U.S. economy continues to kind of limp along. Again, just to remind everybody of context, the U.S. economy is about $15 trillion. World economy is about $63 trillion. I'm just rounding because we're among friends. It's about 23% of the world's economy, and this is all measured by, you know, GDP, gross domestic product. At the beginning of the year, you know, I was thinking that we would see U.S. GDP growth about 3 to 3.5%. I think that may be slightly high, and so, you know, I'm looking at maybe 2.5 to 3%. I don't think any of my fundamental thinking about the economy has changed. I think it's just a little weaker than I thought. And again, just to give you some context, you know, long-term trend line for the U.S. is about a 3.5% GDP growth. And since we're coming off of, you know, a period that that commentators now refer to in quotes as the Great Recession, to have at best maybe trend line growth is kind of anemic. And again, you know, the reason there is that, you know, I think when economies recover, you have to have two essential elements. You have to have a surge in productivity, and then you have to have a surge in confidence. And when you put those two together, that's when you see really strong growth. Here, what we've seen a really strong productivity surge in the U.S. economy, and one of the ways to look at that is, and one of the results is that it's very high unemployment. So when things got tough, you know, corporations, and now we're seeing governments too, both muni and federal governments, you know, cut back on employment and basically did more with less people and got very productive, initially because they had to survive, and now because they're enjoying sort of the fruits of that, the higher profits. What we've seen, though, is we've seen a confidence lag, however, behind that productivity, and that's, I think, dampening growth. And there I'm going to talk about kind of the consumers and then business confidence, although they're very much intertwined. You know, the consumer is still 70% of the U.S. economy. And there, consumer confidence, I think at the margin has gotten better. It continues to get better, but it's really been a mixed bag. And I think there's a few reasons for that. You know, one is the economists talk about this idea of the wealth effect, which is pretty basic, which is just we tend to spend more money when we feel wealthier. And, you know, the two big drivers of wealth for most American families, for most American consumers, are their investments in the stock market, and then how much equity they perceive as in their house. Now, the stock market's been a real plus. I mean, you know, we've seen, as I mentioned, good performance, you know, the first half of the year in the U.S. stock market, and the last 2 years have had, you know, strong returns for the market, again, off of a really tough period. But, you know, we're not to the point where, you know, you don't want to open your 401k anymore, and people are feeling better about the market there. And I think I've mentioned that I thought that was probably the biggest driver of of the quantitative easing, the second round of it, QE2, where I didn't think that the Fed was trying to drive down interest rates to get higher investment. I think they were trying to make bonds unattractive so stocks would be more attractive, so that the market would go up, so that we would feel better. And that's, you know, essentially worked. Now, it's been dampened, though, and why it's kind of a mixed bag, is by housing. Again, I think we all know that housing's been a really painful market the last few years. Again, with a caveat, I'm not talking about the price of anybody's house or any specific neighborhood or city, just looking at it as an overall market. Their estimates are that about 25% of all houses are, all mortgages are underwater. In other words, there's negative equity. We're seeing strategic defaults, which is something that you just never saw until recently. Strategic defaults are, people who fully have the capacity to pay their mortgage, but are making financial decisions to basically walk away and saying, it's worth damaging their long-term credit, because they're feeling like the asset that they've borrowed against is so far underwater. The offsetting that a little bit, though, is because we have seen, substantial declines, and then we've seen the economy getting better, is the affordability index is much better. We're seeing pretty good marginal changes in the number of foreclosures in terms of rates year over year. And so, the way I'm couching this is, although I'm far from bullish on housing prices, because I do worry kind of longer term interest rates at some point have to go up. And when interest rates go up, housing prices go down. But I think housing is starting to finally get less bad. I'm not sure it's getting better. So, it's marginally that's helping, but it's still, in terms of wealth effect, most people are not viewing their house as a great piggy bank. The other thing that's that affects consumers' confidence, again, kind of a mixed bag, is employment. They're, again, not getting much better, but not getting worse. And, I think for those that are employed, and, again, without being too cavalier about it, the employed are really the people who drive the economy. People who are employed are not that fearful that they're going to move from the employed to the unemployed bucket. Now, they're not very bullish that they're going to get, big raises, because you've got over 9% of the population unemployed. And you've actually still got about 16% of the population underemployed. That's a combination of unemployed and then people who had a good marketing job and now you're a barista at Starbucks. And so that number is very high. And there was a question on unemployment, and I'll get to that in the questions. But that has a huge effect on how we spend money. Again, if you think you're going to stay employed, then you tend to be a lot more confident, obviously. And so people are feeling better about that, but again, not feeling like they're going to get big raises. The other thing that's kept consumers from really, expanding their spending is, we're seeing a lot of deleveraging. Leverage, across the board, which is what got us into the big financial issues a few years ago anyway. And that deleveraging is either being voluntary or being forced upon people in terms of credit being scaled back. So by and by, I think we're leading to, an improving but muted consumer confidence. On the business side, you're seeing companies still nervous. Again, they've gotten very productive, but they're still nervous about making big investment spends. They're nervous about the consumer. And I think they're very nervous about the political situation. I think you're seeing a lot of business leaders very nervous about, the party's ability to manage short-term issues and address long-term issues. And that's kind of across the board. That's not sort of political leaning. That's just worried about the system there. And then I think you're also seeing a lot of business people not wanting to make investment because they're not sure what the rules are, both in terms of impending taxation, but then in also kind of regulatory. And so, kind of on a micro level, financial companies, for example, something, hopefully we know about, you know, with the new Dodd-Frank legislation, for example, most of the rules to implement the Dodd-Frank legislation have not even been written yet. So you don't know what the, you know, what ground you're playing under. The other thing that's interesting, and I'll again talk about this more in our views of the capital markets, but I think companies are really enjoying, the big companies are really enjoying being really profitable. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon when if you're running a company in the short term, when you're making more and more money, everybody's feeling really, really good, and not surprisingly. And so, you know, it's easier for CEOs to get big compensation increases and the board to sort of high-five each other. However, you know, there's always that balance about whether you're creating, you know, you're creating that short-term profitability at the cost of kind of missing longer-term value creation in terms of making investments. But coming off such a tough period of a couple of years ago, I think companies, especially the big companies, that are really kind of basking in having these kind of record profitable years, and they don't want to, you know, risk screwing that up by making investments, especially given the backdrop. And then the third thing that's kind of leading to this sort of anemic growth and is government spending. Again, just in terms of context, you know, the U.S. GDP is about 88% driven by the private sector, and 12% is government. About 4% is federal government. 8% are state and local governments. And then, you know, so on the state and local government side, for example, you know, state governments actually do have to balance their budgets. Everybody except for Vermont. And again, how they balance a budget and how a family may balance a budget is pretty different. But you know, everybody's leading to that, and that's they're, you know, cutting back spending, cutting back employment, and raising revenues. I mean, excuse me, the you know, state and local governments have a much greater ability to tax us on a hidden basis than the federal government. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you have a fishing license and this year, it costs you $10 more to renew it, that's a tax increase, essentially. Federal government doesn't have those tools available to it. So you're seeing that. Having said all that, though, you know, I think you have a consumer that is still driving the economy, still spending more money, still a little nervous. Companies making more money, being very careful about investment. So what that's leading to is you know, kind of anemic growth, but I don't see much of a chance of kind of a double dip recession, and that's pretty much where I was in the beginning of the year. Moving to the European Union, you know, and that's about 25% of the world's economy, so just slightly bigger than the U.S. Actually, despite all the headline news, I think you're going to see, you know, sort of 2 to 2.5% GDP growth there. And there, what's driving it is, you know, Germany and France are actually doing okay. They're doing pretty well. And then you've got the PIGS, which, putting Spain aside for a second, so Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Greece are actually fairly small economies, not doing so hot. And so with the European Union, what I'm seeing there is I'm seeing a lot of, I think there's some event risk there. So the most probable scenario is that they muddle through this, and so that you get Greece gets worked out, and so the Greeks, sovereign debt defaults, but nobody ever uses the word default, and you get some combination of sort of the private sector, public sector, the Greeks making some concessions, which they've already made, and you muddle through. And I think Portugal, Ireland, and Italy also kind of muddle through. And again, that leads to, you know, below trend line growth for a while for those four countries, because they're going to take some hits. But again, they're not huge economies, and I'm talking about the global economy. What I mean by event risk, though, is... you know, one is the major event risk is that something happens here that leads to some kind of either demise or major change in the European Union, where you have the where you have countries sort of opt out and you know not use the euro, that would be a big game changer. You have a blow up with Spain. Spain's a much bigger economy than their of the other countries that they get grouped in with the pigs. I think Spain's a different story, but that's and then the last and the word that seems to be tossed around a lot is this idea of contagion, which is that you know this this problem with these with these countries is sort of a canary in the coal mine issue, and so what it does is you know that some kind of default in sovereign debt leads to default in European banks, who hold sovereign debt, which leads to some kind of default in non-European banks, which leads you know and you get this sort of cataclysmic domino effect. I actually don't think that that's a real potential, and I think again everybody's looking for the next contagion because of the recency effect of remembering what happened when we did actually have a financial meltdown and we had this sort of seizing up of the financial system. So everybody wants to see the next, you know, contagion event. I don't think that's there, though. So I think what the European Union is doing is it's adding event risk. Japan, to round out kind of the developed markets, there, I think, you know, we're going to continue to see kind of anemic growth, you know, not recession, but not above 1%. You know, Japan's had sort of tough economic issues for a long time. I think a big part of it is they have very tough demographics. They have a really aging population. They don't have any immigration to speak of, and it's been tough. From a purely economic standpoint, the tsunami actually may be a silver lining to the Japanese economy. The Japanese economy has been pretty moribund for a long time and, you know, locked in this fight with deflation. And deflation is, you know, is really scary for countries because basically if you get into a deflationary environment, what happens is it's always better to spend your money tomorrow as opposed to today because everything is getting a little bit cheaper. So the Japanese economy is a very wealthy economy and there's a lot of money. Most of the Japanese debt, government debt, is actually owned by Japanese citizens. And so here what you need to do is you need to get the velocity of money moving. And all of the damage caused by the tsunami may cause that to occur. Now, the normal thinking is when you have a big event like that, an earthquake, a tsunami, is that at best it has a neutral effect because that money that's getting spent on rebuilding would have been spent on something else anyway. But in Japan, it's different because it wasn't being spent. It was basically just being saved. And so there you may get sort of this forced acceleration of spending. So that may actually end up being a plus. So I've sort of talked on the global economic front. That's kind of the bad news part of it or the disappointing news part of it, U.S., Europe, and Japan. So, you know, why do we think that the global economy is so strong? Well, there you get to the emerging markets. Emerging markets are now about 40% of global GDP. Some of the numbers I've seen say, you know, those should be about half of the GDP in by 2020, probably 60% by 2030. I'm going to talk about China a lot, but it's not just China. It's also Brazil, Russia, India, and Mexico. They're all experienced very strong GDP growth. India should have, 7.5% growth this year. The International Monetary Fund, it's forecasting above 5% real growth for India for the next 20 years. I don't know how you do 20-year economic forecasts, but they did them. And then China is the real story today as to what's driving growth. For those of you who actually watch the market on a daily basis, or if you had the TV on this morning while you were on the treadmill, you probably saw that the U.S. market opened up sharply this morning, and the reason was that China had higher than expected economic growth numbers. You know, China's a $6 trillion economy. It's about 10% of the world's economy. However, that's probably understated because of because of their currency. And so, again, you know, some of the forecasts that I've seen actually predict that in terms of purchasing power parity, which is this concept of, you know, what you can actually buy for your currency. Just as an aside, probably the most interesting way that they measure that is something called the Big Mac Index, which is, you know, kind of what it costs to buy a Big Mac in each of the various cities around the world that McDonald's is in. And then you sort of level that out, and it tells you whether your currency is under or overvalued. But I've seen that some people believe that by 2015, which is right around the corner, China's going to be the largest economy in the world in terms of purchasing power parity. And just, you know, the growth there has been just staggering in kind of all sorts of, in all sorts of ways. You know, the Chinese tend to think of themselves in kind of, you know, centuries old type of thing. And so, you know, for them, I think it's really kind of regaining economic dominance. In, I was just doing a little reading, and in 1820, China was the world's largest economy, and it represented about a third of the world's GDP. And then they had this long economic decline, so by 1950, it was less than 4% of the world's GDP. And that's what led to, you know, to Mao Zedong and the Communist Revolution, and then a bunch of years where they didn't get anything done. But in the you know, the last few years, it's been just spectacular, and it should continue to be so. And it's really being led by, you know, exports and investments. Again, as disappointing as the economic news was in the first half of the developed world, China still had record exports, higher than ever, and higher than expected. And you know, just again, just as anecdotally, some of the things, you know, coming out of China are pretty amazing. You probably saw that they just built the longest cross sea bridge in the world. It's 26.4 miles long. I think more interesting to me than that, although the idea that you could have a bridge that's long enough to run an entire marathon on, it connects the city of Qingdao and an island called Hangzhou. Most of you have probably never heard of Qingdao, which is not in the top 10 cities of China, and it's a city of population of 8 million people. Right now, the U.S. and Japan, for example, we're about 80% urban. China is 50% urban, and it still has 500 of the 1,000 largest cities in the world today. You know, there's estimates that there should be more than 200 Chinese cities with greater than 1 million people right now. Europe has 35, just for numbers. You know, you're looking at building 50,000 new skyscrapers in the next few years. That's kind of the equivalent of 10 New York cities. And so, it's really just pretty spectacular. Now, they have their issues. But their growth is really propelling economic growth around the world, and I think a lot of U.S. investors have not recognized the fact that when you talk about the economic backdrop that we're operating in terms of investing, that you cannot just look at the U.S., that you have to look at the rest of the world. Doesn't mean that we're not important. It just means that we're now codependent, and that is a change. That's a change from when I first started in the business. So with that, you know, what does that mean for sort of you know, earnings going forward, and our feelings about the capital markets? Yeah, at the beginning of the year, we talked about the fact that at First Western we were very bullish on the stock market, and that really hasn't changed, especially for large global companies. I continue to believe that large global companies are going to do well over the next few years. And again, I think you have to look at, global companies. I mean, only, 28% of the 500 largest companies in the world are U.S. domiciled. And even there, when you look at that, half the revenues from the S&P 500 are coming from outside the United States. And especially large companies have the ability to basically move resources around. And so they can focus on markets where they're seeing the most the most demand. And again, so we're seeing an environment where you're seeing a lot of growth. You're seeing a lot of people move into the middle class in these emerging markets. So you're seeing a lot of demand for product, and you're basically seeing. These companies, they've gotten very productive because they've used they use the economic crash to do so. Capital is, for large companies, is very inexpensive because interest rates are low. And a lot of the large, at least U.S. global companies, their workforce is still predominantly U.S. And for the reasons we talked about, U.S. employees don't have a lot of power to get raises. So they're able to keep their costs low. So the question there is then, if we're going to see, if we're going to continue to see strong earnings, what are you going to pay for those earnings? And just as an aside, I mean, the consensus forecast for 2011 for the S&P 500 is to have record earnings, highest earnings ever. And there, I think, you continue to be able, despite the fact that the market's been up for 2.5 years, we're seeing that we're able to buy those stocks on a very reasonable to sometimes even, cheap basis. And I think, there's a variety of reasons for that. One is, despite the fact that the last 2.5 years have been good, in the stock market, the last decade or so has been tough. And, with 2008, I mean, there was, there's only been 3 years in the history of the U.S. market where we saw the market down more than 30%. So two of the years were in the 1930s, and one of the years was in 2008. So I think a lot of people are still very nervous about the market. Markets clearly have more volatility today because of the flow of information, and that scares people. Some of the volatility continues to be pretty unexplained, like the flash crash and things like that. And so you're seeing a lot of retail investors still kind of underweight and tiptoeing back into the market and then fleeing the market when you have any kind of event. So you saw, flows into equity mutual funds start to pick up in the beginning of the year, and as soon as the Japanese tsunami hit, flows went out of the market. So that's leading to the ability to buy very strong earnings and very strong growth in earnings at very reasonable prices. In terms of bonds, we continue not to think that there's a lot of value in long-term U.S. government bonds. I think although there's not a lot of inflationary pressure in the short term, because of the high unemployment, at some point inflation will pick up, and economic activity will pick up, and owning long government bonds is a tough bet against inflation there. Municipal bonds, actually, I think they look pretty good in terms of investing. There again, you saw what happened is because of some of the issues that state and local governments are facing. We saw this big overreaction to the municipal bond market. Very high-profile analysts came out and talked about hundreds of billions of dollars of defaults. And she basically single-handedly took down that market. Clearly that was overblown, but all munis aren't built alike. And so, that's a market where you have to do the work on that. But that market continues to look pretty good to us. And then corporate bonds are kind of okay. You know, I think that you're getting paid reasonably well in terms of the spread against, you know, what you could invest in terms of a risk-free bond if the U.S. government bond is still risk-free, which I believe it is, by the way, despite all the machinations about the idea of defaulting on August 2nd. And then commodity prices, we continue to be, you know, our thesis continues to be that with a, you know, large part of the world getting much wealthier, that there is going to be a fight for basic commodities across the board. And, you know, commodities, like every asset class, you know, nothing moves on a linear basis, but, you know, by and by, they're moving pretty steadily up. And so, you know, we continue to be very bullish on commodities there. So before I get to the questions, kind of in conclusion, you know, I think you have a robust global economy driven by the emerging economies, China, India primarily, but also Brazil, you know, Russia, Mexico, Turkey, places like that. I think the U.S., you've got growth, so not a chance of a double dip recession, but kind of anemic growth. Europe, sort of the same thing. Probably more event risk in Europe than anywhere else these days. But what that's leading to strong corporate earnings on a global basis, the ability to buy them cheaply, which should get you good returns there. Kind of fair value in corporate, municipal, and high-yield bonds. I'd be, you know, nervous about owning long-dated government bonds. And then I think that there's going to be this continuous change in change upward as in commodity prices because of that. So with that, I'm going to move into the questions that we got. And I'll probably have a chance to get to a few of them. So one of the questions was asked about the bank's perspective on the current state of emerging markets and the mechanism the bank has or deploys to track opportunities there. And then, I think I've talked about, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about emerging markets in terms of what it means for economies and our individual managers, you know, people who run stock or bond portfolios spend a lot of time thinking about how the companies that they own or considering owning or considering selling are reacting to opportunities, you know, in those countries. Now notice, you know, when I talked earlier, emerging markets stocks were actually the worst performing of the equities. In the short term, you know, in the long term, markets move, I think, pretty consistently with kind of economics. In the short term, though, they react more to, you know, something that I've stated before, which is perception of rate of change at the margin. So in other words, when things are bad and they start getting less bad, things go up. When things are good and they start getting less good, they go down. You know, things in emerging markets have been good for the last couple of years, and they're starting to be a little bit more worry that it's not sustainable, and that it might slow up a little bit. You know, worried about China overheating. So, you know, I think that's affected it. The other is when we make investment decisions, although we're looking at backdrops and we're trying to sort of swim with the tide keep the wind at our back, investment decisions at their core are micro decisions. And so, you know, I think that you're going to see a lot of opportunity to make good micro decisions in emerging markets. And we have a specialized emerging markets manager that we use, but you have to make those micro decisions. And some of those emerging market countries, China, for example, you know, the quality of the accounting, corporate governance, despite how good the economy is, it's not there. And so sometimes we'd rather play emerging markets growth by, you know, owning a big U.S. global company that's actually able to benefit from that than owning a Chinese company, for example. And Chinese companies have been in the news pretty much lately. And I'm talking about companies operating in China that are now listed in the United States. They basically got listed through these reverse mergers, and they're talking about having, you know, either fraud or major accounting irregularities. So you have to be very careful on a micro level. But from a macro level, we spend a lot of time thinking about kind of the emerging markets and how they're growing things. I got a question about unemployment and what's going to drive down unemployment, and whether there'll be productive jobs or just jobs from the that the government essentially subsidizes, which I thought was a great question. Employment is clearly a lagging indicator of when an economy gets better. Again, you need the productivity, which tends to drive up unemployment, and then you need the confidence to start investing, which brings it down. You know, the interesting thing is you can't force unemployment to go down. It just doesn't work. And getting back to Japan a second, of all of the mistakes Japan made about 20 years ago or so when they had their big crisis, that was probably the biggest mistake, is they had a policy decision that they were never going to let unemployment go above 5%. And what happens there is, they forced all these unproductive companies to stay open so that they could keep people employed. They forced the banks not to foreclose on these unproductive companies, and you literally had people sort of sitting around doing nothing. What you need, I think, for unemployment to come down is for businesses to feel good about the investments. And, you know, I'm hoping that the government gives them a better shot at that. You know, where employment comes from, that's the great thing. You just never know. I mean, when I was getting out of college, if I thought that a Harvard dropout would create a brand new industry, you know, make himself a multi-billionaire and create, maybe 100 other billionaires in the process, and thousands of millionaires and millions of jobs, you know, that would have staggered me. And I'm not talking about Mark Zuckerberg. I'm talking about Bill Gates. You know, today we have our own version of that, and in 20 years we'll have something else. I mean, you just never know where productive jobs are coming from. And that's the great thing about capitalism, and you can't force it. So I'm hoping, you know, that the government, again, you know, puts us in a position where we're feeling confident about creating jobs and doesn't do anything stupid in terms of you know, trying to kind of artificially force down unemployment. You know, the last thing we need is another 5 million TSA employees, for example. Question about how I feel about the $14-plus trillion debt and what we're doing with to defensively position our portfolios. I don't think anybody feels good about the $14 trillion debt. Just to put it in context, though, it's about 100% of GDP, which is too high. On a nominal basis, it's clearly the largest, debt in the world. It's something that we have to deal with. I don't think we've hit a crisis mode, and so we probably won't deal with it until we hit a crisis mode. We're really good at dealing with crises. In this country, it seems like we struggle a little bit more. It is manageable, as big as it sounds. It can grow for a while and still be manageable. Long term, clearly, it's not sustainable. In terms of positioning portfolios, you know, generally, what should happen if we don't get a hold of it is, at some point, we'll see inflation and possibly stagflation. You know, because that's the way that you get out of that. You know, you inflate your way out of it. You basically devalue your bonds. So there, again, I think you have to position your portfolio to think about inflation down the road. And we've had about 20 years of under trend line inflation. Interestingly, the last period that we had of that long of under trend line inflation was kind of in the mid, the early 50s through the early 70s. And then I think some of us are old enough to remember what happened in the mid 70s and early 80s in terms of getting this big pop in inflation. I think the best defensive ways to guard against inflation are to have higher returning assets, and those tend to be equities. And companies also have a lot of mechanism to deal with inflationary periods. So I think, you know, you can be too conservative in your portfolio and own too many bonds. And again, it all depends on your, you know, on your specifics. But and then the other is to have some exposure to commodities, which rise with inflation. And then there were, the last question I'll deal with, because I'm not sure there. I got a couple of questions about the my views on the pending tax legislation, in terms of which tax loopholes will be eliminated in the budget. One was basically the same question, but a little bit more specific, about whether the deduction for second home or HELOC mortgages would go away and what that would mean for the mountain communities in Colorado. I don't think I have any great insight into the legislative process and which of the tax loopholes will be eliminated in the budget. My guess is that, without being too cynical, is that you're not going to see any major changes to the tax structure yet, either in terms of, I think you may see some revenue increases. I mean, you may see the Republicans fold a little bit and have some kind of tax increase with this idea that you're offsetting some loopholes, but I don't see any major changes there. I mean, I think what will happen is they probably hit the, there are a couple of them there that may be, to certain people, kind of egregious and that don't affect a lot of people. You know, basically kind of how you account for tax for carried interest, which are, you know, it's easy to jump on people who are private equity guys and fly around in corporate planes in, you know, their own private jets and stuff. So you'll probably see some of that. But I don't really have a lot of insight into which tax loopholes get closed. Clearly, I think if you know, you have a repeal of the second home deduction, which I don't think is going to happen given the state of housing, that would be tough on people who have, you know, who are in primarily vacation economies, like the mountain communities. So I think I've kind of used up our time here. So with that, thanks, everybody, for your patience, and enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Bye-bye.